Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Tom O'Neill, who, along with his co-author Dan Pippenbring, has authored the brand new book, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Little Brown. Tom, I thought I knew a lot about the Charles Manson case. I've read about it over the years. What I found from reading your book is that I didn't know much, and frankly, not one person has the entire story. Was that sort of what happened when you went into this book?
I ended up, it was kind of like Rashomon. Everybody had a different version of every detail of the case, from why the murders occurred to how they occurred, and then the aftermath, how they were solved.
Well, it seemed like around Hollywood at the time, you know, you had the murders at CLO Drive, the Sharon Tate murders, we'll call them, and everyone in Hollywood assigned blame differently, you point out in the book. So what was going on then in Hollywood as people looked at these murders and, you know, kind of went through the aftershocks?
Well, there was a lot of paranoia because they thought, at least people who knew the first night victims, you know, the Sharon Tate victims, those people believed it was someone among them, you know, somebody that was a friend or acquaintance of theirs. So that made everyone suspicious of each other, and Polanski famously began conducting his own investigation, where he got the prescription for a pair of glasses that were found at the murder scene and started going around trying to get a prescription of glasses of his friends and find out whether his own friends, such as, I think he suspected Bruce Lee at one point, John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas. It just got pretty crazy.
The thing I didn't realize until I read your book, because my basic knowledge of this started with Helter Skelter, the book that Vincent Bugliosi co-authored after the trial, the famous prosecutor, was Terry Melcher. And Terry Melcher, son of Doris Day, music producer, produced The Byrds, Paul Revere and the Raiders, bands like that.
Right.
He was a lot closer to Manson, you found out. He used to live in the Cielo Drive house before Sharon Tate, but he was a lot closer to Manson than anybody ever let on, right?
Well, yeah. And not only did I discover that early on in my reporting, but I found out that Bugliosi was well aware of that and basically conspired with Melcher to suppress that and keep that out of the trial, and worse, not share that information with the defense. And he was obligated to share it with the defense because it was something that impeached the testimony of one of his key prosecution witnesses, Melcher. And when I showed the supporting documents, the two defense attorneys who were still alive, Paul Fitzgerald and Irvin Kanarek, they said that it just not only did it shock them, but they said we would have defended the defendants completely differently if we had known about this. They couldn't believe it, but they saw the papers, and I also showed the documents to Stephen Kay, who was Bugliosi's co-prosecutor on the case, and he was shocked, and he said it changed everything he thought he knew about it changed everything about a case that he thought he knew inside out.
Well, taking this back to the theory of the crime from the prosecution standpoint, Helter Skelter, starting a race war, did it really boil down to something as simple as that from Bugliosi's mindset, or why did he choose that particular theory of the case?
Well, that's why I had to get into speculation in the book. I present a couple possible scenarios, but since I can't definitively say why Bugliosi made this choice, I don't want to put myself online and say it happened because of this, but I mean, Bugliosi himself said in an interview right before he died, and he also said it in an interview a few years after the conviction. Twice I was able to find that he had said this. He was asked whether or not he believed that the killers really believed in this crazy helter-skelter, that there was going to be a race war that ended the world, and the family was going to hide in the bottomless pit in the desert, and then after the blacks had wiped out all the whites on the globe, that the family would emerge, subjugate the blacks, and repopulate the planet with their perfect offspring. And Bugliosi said he had no doubt that the killers believed it, the women and Tex Watson, but that he didn't think for a second that Manson believed it. neither of those two reporters asked Bugliosi the obvious follow-up. Well, if Manson didn't believe in this reason for what the murders were committed for, this, you know, to ignite this race war, why did he send these people up there to kill these supposed strangers? And then enough of the strangers the second night. Now, I interviewed them extensively, but I didn't do my best job finding all this information because the first interview that was in Penn, I think in 74 or 75, I hadn't seen, or I would have asked them that follow-up question. And then if you, your listeners read the book, they'll see at some point, Bugliosi and I did our relationship pretty dramatically with him threatening lawsuits against me and not speaking to me anymore. And then he gave that second interview to Rolling Stone in 2015. And I couldn't, you know, I wanted to almost just show up at Bugliosi's house and ask him if Charlie didn't send them there to commit, you know, to ignite Helter Skelter, why did he send them there to kill? You know, what was the real reason? Unfortunately, I couldn't get to Bugliosi.
What was Charlie Manson's relationship with Terry Melcher prior to the murders and in the months following that you found?
Well, all I can do again is go on the reports I found that were suppressed by Bugliosi, but just showed it was much more extensive. That, you know, several of the Manson families lived at the house with him when he lived there. And then most, you know, kind of astonishingly, after the murders were committed, Melcher was seen with Manson twice, once at the Spahn Ranch, which was about 45 minutes outside of Los Angeles, where the family lived communally until the end of September, and he was seen there, I think it was the first week of September with them, and then later, in mid to late September, he was out with the family at the Barker and Myers Ranch in Death Valley, which is a pretty long, arduous trip, you know, because you have to get through the desert on a four-wheel drive to get up to Colville Wash, where he had this meeting with them. So all that stuff was kept out of the official narrative, and one can only speculate about what the relationship was. I offer a little bit of hints and evidence from the reports that there might have been something going on between Melcher and the women, possibly young, underage women that would have been illegal for him to be involved with, or more. But I can't, again, there's so much, this is why the book took so long to write, was kept trying to find, you know, what really happened. And either documents were withheld from me, people wouldn't talk, people threatened to sue me. So what I found, I think, was pretty, is pretty compelling, but unfortunately there's still holes, you know. And that's one thing I'm hoping that this book will do, is get other people to go out there and pick up where I left off and see if they can get this information. Because after 20 years, I'm just too exhausted to keep doing it. That doesn't mean I won't do a follow-up book. I'm actually talking about that with my collaborator now.
I'm chatting with Tom O'Neill about his brand new book, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s. It's available now from Little Brown. Tom, the thing that I think probably people think is, you're not arguing that the Manson family wasn't guilty of these murders, but rather the reason for it. So had reports not been suppressed by Bugliosi and defense attorneys had seen this, what would necessarily have changed in the trial?
Well, I'm not arguing that the people that went to prison for committing them didn't commit them, but I am arguing that because of the evidence and information that was suppressed, withheld, concealed by Bugliosi and other people at the prosecutor's office, there could easily have been other people that were involved that actually weren't integral parts of the Manson family, but they were peripheral people that could have been protected, and that'll make more sense to people when they read the book. And also, the reasons for the murder could have been entirely different. And just the fact that we know that, you know, Bugliosi could warn perjury and several of his key prosecution witnesses means that we have to ask, you know, what did really happen and why was it covered up? And no matter how evil these people were, their acts, everybody, you know, from Hitler to Saddam Hussein deserves a fair, well, Saddam Hussein is an American citizen, neither is Hitler, but in our country, everyone deserves a fair trial. And you'll see I have other evidence, not only didn't they get a fair trial, but the prosecution switched attorneys on one of the most pivotal defendants, Susan Axton, who provided the first narrative of the case, and they had a secret arrangement with a former prosecutor to insert himself into the case. That happened before the family was even openly reported to be suspect in the murder. So the entire case was poisoned from the outset by the prosecutors, and we don't really know any of the questions, any of the answers to those first three questions that we were discussing, how, you know, why, and who. All of that stuff is now, I think, unanswerable until we get more documents or someone comes forward.
One of the other things that always amazed me about this case is the whole family was arrested shortly after the murders for a bunch of burglaries and car thefts and things like that. And they were released right away because there was no evidence. You take great pains in the book to, well, they were released purportedly for a lack of evidence. There, you take great pains in the book to explain that when the ranch was raided, the Spahn Ranch, that was a huge operation, and people were shocked that these charges were dismissed. So what was going on there? I mean, you even give hints in the book that Manson, that people think Manson may have been an informant.
Right, right. Well, the raid occurred almost exactly a week after the Kate LaBianca murders, the following weekend, August 16th. And it was, to that point, the largest police operation in the history of the state of California. The next largest, and I think the only bigger one since, was the SLA confrontation in Los Angeles when the police surrounded a house and had SLA members where I think three or four of them died in a fire. That, you know, they had all this evidence. It was a 16-page search warrant that I found, and Manson was named as a ringleader of this group that was stealing cars and distributing and selling narcotics. And Manson was identified as someone who was currently on federal parole. And there were not only weapons that were confiscated in this raid and the evidence of the stolen cars and evidence of stolen credit cards that were in Manson's pocket, but he was in violation of three or four different points of parole. You know, he wasn't allowed to be around weapons. It was an automatic weapon, a machine gun. He wasn't allowed to be any criminal activity, and they had all these stolen cars that they confiscated. He was also around young runaway girls. He should have been violated immediately by his parole officer. And you see in the book that after about 2 years of a Freedom of Information Act request battle with Bureau of Prisons and Probation and Parole, I got access to about two-thirds of Manson's parole record from those 2 years, 67 to 69, and discovered that Manson was arrested many more times than Bugliosi reported in Helter Skelter, and each time he was released when not only should he have been charged and tried, but he should have been violated at the very least and sent back to prison. And when I took down evidence to several people, but most importantly, a retired DA from Los Angeles, he said this guy was clearly, he goes, sometimes this can be explained away by incompetence or bureaucratical mistakes, but he goes, in this case, it's just too consistent. He looked at all the reports I had. He said somebody wanted this man out on the streets. He was more important out than in. There's no way this was due to incompetence. This was a deliberate decision, and he was working. He said he, Manson was definitely working as an informant. He challenged me. He said, you've got to find out who he's working for.
Well, you started this project as a story at the 30th anniversary of the murders for Premier Magazine. You never published that article, but this thing took over your entire life for 20 years. As a writer, researcher, investigative journalist, do you get the sense, I mean, knowing, talking to all the people that you were there at the time, does it have that same feeling to you that it would be as if you were covering all this in real time?
I'm sorry, do you mean if I was covering it at the time the crimes happened?
Right.
Well, I always wish that I had been, because you're always skeptical when you're interviewing anybody, no matter how close they were to the event. 30 years later, which is what I was doing, you know, everybody can conflate things and embellish things, not even deliberately misremember things, and that was what was really important to me in the beginning was, once I started hearing there's an interviews from people who had never talked to a journalist before, this, you know, counter-narrative, I thought, maybe these guys are just old and forgetting, misremembering. But that kind of sent me on my chase to get documents that hadn't been released before, not just Manson's parole file, but records of the DA's office, the LAPD investigation, the sheriff's investigation. You'll see in the book I got them, but it took me more than a year to get access to a lot of them. And then once I found them, it corroborated what people told me in interviews. But yeah, it did kind of feel like it was in real time, because once you're sitting down with some of these people, you know, who lived through this, and they're reminiscing, and for some of them it was the first time they ever talked to a journalist, they're right back there in that moment as if it's happening again. And I have people breaking down in tears, and you know, Michelle Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, I took her to lunch, and we were discussing, you know, what happened the night of the murders of Sharon, who was very close to her. And she said, excuse me a minute, and she went to the ladies' room, and when she came back, she said, I just threw up. She goes, I've got to leave. I can't do this anymore. I mean, she said, I felt so sick, and I haven't really thought about it like this for many, many years. And that happened a lot, that kind of thing. So, yeah, maybe it did feel kind of like it was in real time.
Well, then before I let you go, I got to ask, there was one interesting point I thought of the people that turned you down for an interview. One was Bruce Dern. And he was sort of tangentially involved, knew Tate and Polanski. But he turns you down for an interview, but he ends up playing George Spahn in Tarantino's new movie. That was kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Burt Reynolds was originally supposed to play that role, and then he passed away. And when I saw something in the papers about Bruce Dern getting cast, I thought, oh, maybe now he'll talk to me, but it was too late, because the book was mostly written and done by then. And yeah, he turned me down, his wife, Diane Ladd, who, you know, he's been married to for years, but they were married at the time. Not only did she turn me down, but I think she threatened to sue me if I even mentioned her name in my book. I mean, people were really still freaked out about it all those years later.
That's just one of those cases that never goes away, and we still don't know the answers 50 years later. The book is Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold. From the good folks at Little Brown, Tom O'Neill is the co-author, along with Dan Pipenbring. Tom, just an absolute wonderful book. I learned so much from it.
Thank you.
And now I have more questions about it as I go on, so I look forward to anything more you write on it. But thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Great. Yeah, call me anytime. We'll do a second follow-up.
Sounds good.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Now I have